Good evening. Oh, nice to see everyone. Since our weekend, those of you who participated in the weekend, you know that the subject was the Day of the Dead and Halloween. And the theme has kind of been continuing for me in the sense that I've stayed with it. And today the phrase came to me that we, at the end of Orioki, you know, we say, may we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. In French, we say, dans l'eau boueuse, puissions nous demeurer pur comme un lotus. And this is the kind of thing we say without even really thinking about it. With a lot of the Orioki chant, we don't really think about it. And yet there's some really beautiful, meaningful things in that chant. And this one of existing, so the muddy water, what's the muddy water? And what does it mean to exist with purity, like a lotus? So we know that, I mean, you know, botany, we know that lotuses blossom in mud. And so it seems like a nice image that, you know, in mud, this flower blossoms. But why do we say that at the end of the Orioki? What are we talking about here? So what does it mean to blossom in the mud? What's the mud? The mud is here and now, this life that we know, right? This in the relative world where marked by impermanence. So we know old age, death, sickness, loss, pain. That's the mud. In the traditional teachings, the Buddha refers to it as suffering. Somewhere I read, I don't remember where a Buddhist text or teacher or something who said, in our modern language, lingo, in our modern usage, we would say shit happens. Instead of suffering, we would say shit happens. Which is maybe appropriate because we all know that this is an expression from English, shit happens. We all know that that's true. We have no difficulty acknowledging that. With life is suffering, we maybe have a little more problem. We say, well, what do we mean by that? You know. But shit happens, we know, right? We get sick, our knee hurts, the cat knocks over a glass, I break a wine glass when I'm drying it, the car breaks down, somebody loses their job, someone dies, you know, it could, or just, you know, the days are getting darker. We changed time on the weekend, so the days are getting darker. Shit happens. We can all relate to that more or less, probably. So in the midst of shit happens, the lotus, the flower blossoms, right? What does that mean really though? And what does it mean, the purity of the lotus? Because we say that too. Every time I hear this phrase, shit happens, I think of Genpo Roshi, my teacher's teacher, who took it one step further, as he always does with things, much more radical. And he said, shift happens. which is actually much deeper than shit happens. I mean, sometimes we can be in deep shit, but shift, you just add the letter F in there, shift happens. This is impermanence. And that's why we think of it as shit, because it's shift. And we don't like shift. Shit we can handle sometimes, but shift, wow, that's tough. So Genpo always used to say, shift happens. Which is, you know, a really deep teaching. All the flowery traditional Buddhist texts talk about impermanence and, you know, the abiding nature of change and all these beautiful ways of phrasing it. But shift happens. It's really simple. Shift happens. We see it. So old age, sickness, death, the cat's growing older. There's a cat that's sitting on my lap since I signed on. Behaving pretty much because she's sleeping, but the cats are growing bigger. The days are growing darker, colder, rainier. We each are growing older. Our children are growing older. Our parents are growing older. The leaves are changing color on the trees. And we tend to think that the leaves are beautiful when they change color. We tend to really like it. Some people in the northeast part of the United States, there are people who go on special vacations to view the changing leaves. Or people who go to Japan or Washington, D.C. to, in the springtime when the cherry trees are in blossom, to see the beautiful colors and the beautiful blossoms. We also think of the changing, the gold and the green and the yellow, not green, brown, gold, orange, red. The leaves are fabulous sometimes as they change. Because they're changing, they will fall. Every leaf will fall. I mean, of course, there are some trees that are evergreen, as we say, and their leaves won't fall. But at least in our part of the Northern Hemisphere, most of the leaves on the trees will fall. And usually we don't have much problem with that. You know, people don't like it because they have to clean the leaves away. For some reason in my street, all the leaves congregate in front of my house. Not Donna, the house next door. It's right in front of my house. I think it's because it's like at the end of the line of houses, so they all congregate there. So what? No. But it's not one of the more beautiful aspects of the spectacle of leaves changing color. And yet it's just part of it. The leaves, first there are buds on the trees, and then blossoms and leaves, green leaves, full, lush. And then the leaves start changing colors, and then they fall, and then the branches are bare again. Okay, shift happens. But when it happens to us, when our hair changes color, when our teeth fall out, when we have wrinkles, when we're more tired than we were before, even when you're 30 years old, you can see the difference between when you were 20, usually. And then when you're 40, you can really see the difference between 40 and 30. And then 50 and 40, it's always a degree of difference. Shift happens. Now, if we look at this from, what's purity of the lotus? In French, demeurer, you know, to stay, right? So may we stay in this mud, in this shit, with purity like a lotus, because it's about staying here, right? It's not about running away. And because this is, you know, the bodhisattva path, that's among our vows, is to stay here, right? To not go off and disappear into the, you know, parinirvana, whatever some other traditions believe in. So how do we do that then? And what does it mean exactly? In this muck, this mud, I think it's Thich Nhat Hanh, who, the Vietnamese teacher, who, you know, said something like, talking about this analogy, that from the mud of suffering, we learn compassion. So when we suffer, whatever it is, you know, we're suffering because we're growing older. Well, then we can appreciate the suffering of someone who's even older than us. And we can have a little compassion for those people that we wouldn't have if we weren't in contact with our own suffering. Or the story I often tell of a month-long Dana retreat in Normandy, in Pimoutier, where we always went, where it was, you know, huge. You know, I don't know how many people. It seemed like there were 100 people. There probably weren't, but it was big. And there were all these Polish people there. It was in the days when the Polish people didn't have much money, and Roshi let them come basically for free. And there was this Polish woman sitting across from me, and we were quite close because there were the inner rows, and we were in the inner rows. She cried the whole time. I mean, the whole time. It was probably a week. Probably wasn't the whole month, but it was a week. She cried every meditation period, endlessly cried. And it drove me crazy. I couldn't stand it. I was having my own problem. I was stuck on a koan, and I was annoyed with Roshi, and I was annoyed with everybody else, and I was really pissed off, and mad at my husband, and probably yelled at my kids, because they were all there too. And this woman just was, what's her problem? Can't she just get over it, whatever it is? Or cry outside of Zazen, you know, something. And then at one point, it was even to the point where Roshi in those days used to do these things she called group daisan. I don't know if Jan remembers this, but, or Debbie, I don't know. Where in the afternoon, instead of doing individual daisans, she would have a group of people. I was the Jisha, and I had to call these people. Everybody got their turn to be in a group, but we went, and then, you know, you could talk, but it was in a group because she was really tired. She had no assistant teachers at the time. It was really intense for her to have Doku-san, it was Dai-san in those days, for a month all the time. And so I had to go because I was the Jisha. I had to go in there and get these people. I had to bring them back out, and then I had to sit there through the group daisans. And it was to the point where I couldn't stand it, the people talking about their stuff. I literally had to like turn away and face the window because I was just so up to here with it. Actually, I was up to here with myself. I didn't realize it. It was them. They were the ones who were causing all the problems. And at one point, you know, something happened, I don't remember exactly the details, but I suddenly saw something. It had to do with my koan, and I saw something, and the whole bottom fell out, and I started crying. And it was such a fabulous release. And suddenly, I saw the woman across from me. I got it. I have no idea what she was crying about. It was probably nothing to do with what I was crying about. It doesn't matter. But I got it. And all the other people who I couldn't even look at during these group daisans, I got it. I threw in, by really going into this mud of my suffering, there arose this lotus blossom of compassion for the others. That's the purity of the lotus blossom, is that it just awakens to what is. It arises out of the situation as it is and doesn't try to push it away or change it. So I was no longer resisting my own suffering, which meant that I didn't need to resist the sufferings of the others. Right? So to go back to Thich Nhat Hanh, that was a long winding thing about from the mud of suffering, we learn compassion. And then he said from our adversity, because part of the shift and shit that happens, part of the suffering is adversity, you know, things that are difficult. We have to go through difficult things. You know, it can be a divorce, it can be the loss of a job, it can be, you know, taking care of a sick parent or a sick child. It can be uncertainty, not knowing what to do, not knowing what to choose. Should I choose this job or that job? Not being able to find a job. And these are just the big things. We can look at tiny little daily things too. That can take on big proportions, right? So if we really face that adversity, that mud, that shit or that shift, through that we discover our own strength. So for example, you know, another story I tell is when I first went to Portugal and I didn't know anyone, nobody knew anything. I had nothing, no cushions, no bells, nothing. I had to start from zero. It was terrible. In the beginning, nobody came. I thought of quitting. Nobody was coming in Paris either. And I thought, okay, forget it. I'm not going to do this. Just forget it. But I didn't. And shift happened. And I am so grateful for that experience of that adversity, because it gave me incredible strength and incredible faith, maybe trust, to just trust that, it, you know, just go to the basics. What's the point? Stay with the essence. And that was fine. It's fine. I learned great strength through this. Out of the mud of suffering, out of the mud of adversity, and then out of the mud of loss. Okay, that's a big one, right? Our whole weekend we spent talking about loss, about death. And yet it wasn't a sad weekend. I mean, it was very joyous in the end, because we were also celebrating life. We were being inspired by the Mexican practice of Day of the Dead. You remember and celebrate. So, and that these people have not actually gone anywhere. It's just a different form, but they're still among us, these beings who have died. Anyway, from loss, we gain a deeper appreciation or experience of impermanence, and appreciation for life. That's what happens in this, seeing this impermanence of the changing of the seasons. Like I said, it's not an accident that these celebrations, Day of the Dead, All Souls Day, All Saints Day, Halloween, it's not an accident that they happen at this time of year, because this is a time of year when a big shift happened from the end of the harvest, the end of summer and the lush abundance of summer, the warmth, the light, the beauty, the fragrance, it's all darkening. It's all shifting into something dark, barren, cold. And yet, from that loss, there is also abundance, right? So we know that so the loss of the warmth also at the end of the season brings the abundance of the harvest, but it also brings kind of a deepening, a turning inwards. Animals do it, right? My cats sleep all afternoon and night. In the morning, they want to go outside and have fun, but then they're just like they're turning inward. And we can do the same thing. We use this holiday that we just had to do that and to look more deeply into the, you know, how, what is impermanence? What is this shift that happens? And by doing that, we can appreciate this very moment. You know, this is at once the last moment and the first moment of your life. And already now it's another one. So because it's not staying, because shift happens, be here now, right? Because you may not be here in the next moment. We don't know, right? This is not knowing. Not knowing is all about impermanence. So from that, from loss, whether it's loss of youth, loss of light, loss of health, loss of life in the sense of dying, loss of a loved one, loss of hair, loss of anything, you know, loss of a pair of shoes you really liked, loss of your internet connection, whatever. From that loss, we can find a deeper understanding of impermanence if we really look into it. And we can see, when we see into impermanence, we can more appreciate this moment, life, the whole of life. Bernie Glassman always said, Shikantaza, the famous Shikantaza, which is the just sitting practice in Zen, it's a Japanese word for it. He always said it's awakening to the wholeness, to the whole of life. The whole of life. In this very moment, can we awaken to the whole of life? We can. You know, let's, you know, use Obama's slogan. Yes, we can. We can awaken to it right now. Even as shift is happening. Because in fact, we are shift happening. We're not separate from it. And when we realize that, then we can fully appreciate this moment. And nothing is going and nothing is coming. We are the movement. You know, everything is moving. But this is not an easy thing to realize when we are attached to things. You know, if I hang on to this stick, you know, then I'm like, I'm this Zen master and I have to be a certain way and I have to hold this stick and I have to say certain things. And then I've completely lost. Last week we were talking about beginner's mind. Completely lost it. You know, I've completely lost the shift. I'm stuck. Like in the river, if we're like floating down the river and then we grab a branch that's hanging from the shore, okay, we're holding the branch and we're in that spot, but we've lost the shift. We've lost the flow of the river of life. We're hanging on to something. And when we can, so when we can appreciate, can we, when we can more deeply understand impermanence, then the tone and the taste and the feeling of loss is different. And that's when the lotus blooms, because you are the lotus. You are the mud, but you are also the lotus. And that's why you can bloom there in the mud. And that's why also you are not stained by the mud. You are it. So there's nothing outside of you to stain you. You are everything. So that's a really interesting phrase that we chant at the end. Now, why do we chant it at the end? I don't really know. You know, we say, may we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. And then we say after, it's not the last thing, after that we say, thus we bow to Buddha. So, I don't know. I've never really studied the Oryoki chant, although there's lots of phrases in it that come back to me regularly. The lotus flower is, you know, it's used regularly in Buddhist imagery because of this. It's like a perfect representation of what our life is. That we have these two, we think of the mud and the purity, the dirt and the purity, and yet they are one, and from the dirt comes purity. So, and that's really sums up what our practice is about. Being one with whatever it is. So, if anyone would like to say something, any ideas about why we chant it at the end, or opinions? Or thoughts, whatever comes up for you.
It came to me the suggestion that thus we bow to Buddha, thus we bow to life, we acknowledge life, we become one with life. You were talking about just now, becoming one. It's because, so when we do the bows in the retreats at the end or Tuesday nights, and we do the full bows, and we are, there is always this sort of explanation how we are not actually bowing to the, we are bowing to the image, of course, but we should be aware, we could be aware that it's not something which is outside of us, which is not myself. That's not maybe what's happening. And so thus we bow to Buddha. I bow to life. I acknowledge life such as it is. That's just a suggestion that came to me.
Yeah, nice. Well, let me ask you another question, kind of off subject, but in 2 weeks, I've been invited to participate in a weekend in a different city in France, where different teachers have been invited to share their practice too. And I am the Zen representative. And so I'm supposed to give a workshop on Zen meditation, a workshop. It's an hour and 10 minutes. And it's like every hour there's a different teacher who does something. And at the beginning, on the Friday night, they introduce all the teachers and each teacher is asked to bring something that will be sitting on the altar throughout the weekend. Something that they say, a symbol of your practice, a picture of your master or guru, a book that's important, something that reflects your practice. I have no idea what to bring. Any suggestions? What comes to mind when our practice? I mean, I almost feel like I should bring nothing because that's what is appropriate for our practice. But I don't know. No. If anyone has any ideas, I'm open to them. Debbie?
How about wildflowers?
I thought of flowers. I thought of that. Yeah. I thought of that. But I don't know if that would be taken as, maybe there's already flowers on the altar, but it doesn't matter. You're right, you know, it doesn't matter. I did think of that. Krisha?
Hi, everyone. I want to go back and I also have a suggestion. I don't know if Jan wants to make a suggestion first. Because I want to go back in the muddy waters because my PC went down and when I was going to ask, I don't know what happened. My suggestion, what about the Zen symbol, the zero with the emptiness, the touching circle with the emptiness, you know, that image.
Yes. In that case, I would have to make it. I would have to do it.
No, you can print it.
And yeah, I wouldn't want to do that though.
Okay. No, so you can paint it.
That's a possibility too.
You can paint it. And what I wanted to go back, I never know the chanting in the Orioki, so well because, you know, I'm Oriokin and it's difficult. So it's from muddy waters, it comes what? Purity of, how is the...
May we exist in muddy waters with purity like a lotus.
With purity like a lotus. Okay, I don't know. This is just to share, I think. In one of your retreats with you in Sermonde, I was that one who cried every goddamn meditation session. And I was also the Jikido. So I had the sense that everybody was looking at me and I sobbed the whole retreat. But I wasn't, bad. I don't know. By the end of it, there was, one meditation experience. It came a big bliss. It was a big relaxation in the body. It felt like a big love and a big bliss, an incredible bliss of calm and peace. And I never got this, I don't have, but sometimes it comes back. I don't know what it means, but I did navigate it through muddy waters. That was only sobbing in there. And I took the time, I don't know. I don't know what happened, but it was purity that came from it, I think. I just wanted to share this.
Nice, thank you. I remember that you were the Jikido there, but I don't really remember that you were crying all the time. But maybe I couldn't see you.
Okay. Oh God, I think, did I? I was thinking, I hope I didn't annoy them.
Yeah.
I was thinking about a famous Zen book. It's made in Holland, and the title is "Everything About Zen." And then you open the book, and every page is empty. It's a very thick book. Yeah. So the first time I took that book out of the shell, it's by Franz Mayer. I believe he had it.
And, oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And I was shocked. I remember, yeah.
Yeah, that's another thing, yeah.
Yeah.
I could actually make a book like that too, couldn't I? I could have a notebook and on the cover say everything about Zen and then, yeah.
Yeah.
Good idea too.
Yeah. I loved your talk. It is the first time I felt that the mud and the lotus were one.
Ah.
This is the image of the lotus is so easy to understand for me as my life, and then the environment as the muddy water of the that I always understood it like that. And then the environment is in me, and that I grow on what's in me. But the white lotus is such a contrast to the black mud. So I always seen it as two. And it's maybe also that the image has the anorganic environment, the mud, and then the living cells of the bloom, that I always felt it as two worlds, actually.
And yet.
Yeah.
I mean, they are two, but they're also one, yeah.
Yeah. Interbeing was the thing that Thich Nhat Hanh said, like the sun is in the flower, and the water is in the flower, and the mud is in the flower. Everything is there.
Exactly.
Your attention. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you can look in a cup of tea and see that. He said, I think that's another image he uses. That in the cup of tea, there is the water and the sun and the, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Lisa?
Hello. I don't really know what I want to say, but it's just reflecting on what you were, what brings us to this practice, and the realization of the suffering, and well, not the realization, but being deep in it, and wanting to, well, I don't know if it's wanting to come out of it, but I was just thinking that it's, if it is what brings us to this practice, I don't know if it's the case for everyone, but in terms of it's just thinking of, I'm sorry, I'm not being very clear, and I don't quite know what I want to say, but it says something about this practice that's maybe what I want to say, that this suffering aspect, and that's, and if it's what, you know, brings people to it, or what does it say about this practice? The liberation from it. So that's what you come to learn after, or discover, or whatever. I'm sorry. It's very confused and not making much sense, but there's something about it. Does everyone that comes to this practice goes through the same, or comes to it because of the same suffering?
Well, generally we say yes, everyone comes here because they are suffering, but that, you know, that's a huge generalization that includes a whole vast palette of possibilities of what that means. Suffering can be simply, a dissatisfaction with the way your life is at the moment, or just not knowing who you are, or, you know, there's all kinds of ways that it can be expressed. So it's not like everyone is, you know, in dire despair or something. Some people are. But not everyone is. And some people come and say, oh, no, I'm not suffering. That's not why I came. But if they stay around long enough and they start delving into it, then they discover it. Maybe that's not why they came initially, but they will make contact with it. Usually, if you sit long enough, if you sit still and let things come and go, you'll encounter impermanence and your struggle with it and the three poisons, greed, anger, and ignorance, and, you know. So it does, yeah. And as someone pointed out during the weekend when we were talking about the parable of the mustard seed, the Buddhist story of sending a woman who lost her child to bring a mustard seed from a house where no one had ever died. And of course she couldn't, he said, if you bring me that mustard seed, I will bring your child back to life. And he, of course, she couldn't, because there was no house where no one had ever died. And someone pointed out how different that approach is to, I forget what it was exactly, the Christian approach, where, you know, it's telling you about, you know, if you do good in this life, you will be, have, you know, in the afterlife will be brilliant, or God will take care of you, or something like that. It's a very different approach. You're just supposed to have faith in the Christian tradition, and whatever. That's also a great generalization, but it is a really different basic point. And I think that will attract different people then. You know, you may feel an affinity with this practice where you're being told, don't believe what I'm telling you, go find out for yourself. Experience it yourself. You're being asked to experience directly the essence of life and death. So you're right, it does say something about this practice. I mean, you're right. I don't mean it like you're wrong or you're right. But yes, it's a good point that it is. It does say something about this practice. That's why Genpo Roshi's, what he points to, shift happens, is really profound, because it's taking away this kind of martyrdom of suffering. You know, we think, oh, you know, I'm suffering so much or something. And pointing to really just our basic experience every day of things shifting, of things not staying still like we want them to stay. You know, we say, oh, you know, I ran out of time. Or, you know, we have this notion that time is getting away from us. It's, things are shifting. I don't have any more butter. Or, you know, whatever it is, the kids are getting old and they're gone, you know, whatever. Things change. And that we all know directly. Like I said in the beginning, suffering, we might say, well, I don't know. Yeah, but it's not so bad. Shift happens, that's all the time. Now, I'm quoting Genpo Roshi saying this. This is probably from 10 years ago. He probably doesn't even say that anymore. Shift happens, right? He's probably moved on to something else now. I haven't seen him for a few years, and I don't know what he's talking about now, but it's still true. Shift happens. So when we hear this shift happens, it doesn't mean so hang on tight because it's going to get away from you. It means live it fully now. You know, really enjoy it now. Take advantage of this situation. Be here. Be awake.
Amy?
Yeah. Claudia?
Yeah. Hello, everybody. I went for a walk today because I'm in the countryside, and there was this huge river, and I stay a very long time to watch this river, and the current was very, very strong, and very powerful. And I don't know, I could feel the energy coming from the movement. And it was so strong, and it was so, I don't know, it was so powerful, you know? And I thought that just the movement could make that. And that was the strongness of impermanence. And I thought that there was like a chance to be impermanent. So just wanted to share that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, beautiful image. And that is so, that it is so powerful. You know, that's the movement of life, just this strong current of life that we resist. We try to resist often. Sounds crazy, but we don't really want to be alive. We want to be alive, but not really. So, yeah. Was it a big river?
I don't know what is a big river.
I mean, like, was it the Loire or something? Or was it like...
It was not a river. It was a cours d'eau.
Ah, okay.
No, so it was a small, right? Yeah, okay. A small. But it was one in the mountain. So very, like, huge rocks. And the water was jumping from one rock to another one. And
it was
alive.
Yeah, that's that kind of thing, like a mountain stream like that. The Taoists and even Dogen, you know, they used to say that's the best place to meditate, actually, because of what you're saying, because it's so alive, and because that impermanence is so present. And so, yeah, the Taoists in China, they would sit in front of those rivers forever, just meditating on it. Really, really good object for meditation.
Yeah, hello. I was thinking about still on the lotus and the mud being one or being two, and I thought actually like the pain and the shift and the shift is also in a way the lotus itself, as like the pain can be like a beautiful thing, as it can show us that we care for something, for somebody, or and the shift, yeah, it's like with the spring flowers, or it makes us feel alive, and therefore it's also really beautiful, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what makes us feel alive, in fact, yeah. The shift. If there wasn't shift, we would be dead. Yeah, beautiful. And often what we do is we like the shifts, like springtime, because it's beautiful and smells nice and everything. And we don't like the shift in the winter, you know. But it's all just shift.
Yeah.
It's alive. If it didn't, wasn't alive, it wouldn't shift. You're right. I think we're out of time, folks. Sorry. Thank you for your wise comments and suggestions for objects that I might bring to my conference. I'll ask you again next week if you have any ideas. And I think, do we need to make any announcements? No, I don't think so. We will be starting a study group soon in the next few weeks, and we'll send some information about that. But it will be flexible in the sense that you don't have to show up every week. And I mean, you can drop in and or not, but we'll send out some information about it. So we do the vows? Nope.